Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Dr. Barry Byrne, Chief Medical Officer at the Muscular Dystrophy Association and Director of the Powell Gene Therapy Center at the University of Florida, to discuss recently published guidelines from the MDA and PPMD on the delivery and monitoring of gene therapy in Duchenne muscular dystrophy. In the interview, Byrne discussed the reasons behind these recommendations, the most important clinical takeaways, and the ways to best manage and mitigate adverse events. In addition, he spoke about how these guidelines address real-world challenges around access, including geographic barriers, language considerations, and financial constraints. Let's dive in.
About a year ago, when groups who were caring for patients with neuromuscular disorders started to consider what the future might be for having access to beyond the investigational products which were already being used, and we felt that with widespread use of gene therapy products in a variety of settings, it was important to develop some considerations for the care of those patients, both patient selection, the specifics of the administration of gene therapy products, and most importantly, we thought that as we gain more clinical experience, there's a need to understand long-term follow-up options.
Obviously, this is a realm that we're still kind of figuring out right now. Obviously, there's only a few gene therapy approved products right now, mainly in the neuromuscular field, which has kind of been leading the charge for gene therapy. So for our clinical audience, and especially for neuromuscular specialists who treat patients with DMD, just discuss a little bit of the top line and major considerations from this published paper. Just what should clinicians know from a top line level?
What the group did was to meet regularly in order to establish some general principles for the care of patients who are anticipated to receive gene therapy. And I think one of the most important take-home messages is that there are a variety of subspecialty practices that contribute to the care of patients, even in the regular conduct of our clinical care within multidisciplinary clinics in the Muscular Dystrophy Association care centers, and that we needed to even amplify that multidisciplinary care further when it comes to applying gene therapy products, in part because we had some early evidence that there were safety signals that needed to be closely monitored, and that involves our colleagues in hematology, cardiology, nephrology, even and especially in immunology. So the consensus opinion was to have all of those team members aware of all of the particulars of use of a given product, and to help manage both acute and the late chronic events that have been observed that are really all often immune-mediated safety events. So, you know, the number one takeaway of all this is that we have to ensure that these products are safe in order to fully realize the direct benefit that they might bring to patients. So that's really where we landed on establishing best practices to enhance safety.
Yeah, it's very, very important. Obviously, gene therapy is a little bit different than some of our other approved therapeutics right now. And there is another kind of safety element to gene therapies and administering them in the proper ways, which kind of leads me to my next question. You kind of delved upon it a little bit there, talking about the multidisciplinary team aspect of things, but can you go into a little bit more detail in terms of the standard protocols for monitoring and managing adverse events related to gene therapies? What should the clinical community be aware of when talking about monitoring and managing these AEs?
So traditionally, since particularly in Duchenne, patients may be receiving chronic glucocorticoid therapy. We know that some aspects of the acute inflammatory responses are influenced by the steroid dosing, and that it had become routine to increase the glucocorticoid use around the period of the gene therapy. In some cases, that wasn't sufficient to manage the subacute liver inflammation. And so this aspect of endothelial injury that leads to abnormalities in the liver function test, the AST, ALT, and the GGT, the gamma-glutamyl transferase, are monitored in weekly in patients following gene therapy. We now have some recommendations that are following an expert panel that was convened by Sarepta to look at how alternative agents will enhance the safety of this therapy, particularly a drug that's used in transplantation called rapamycin. And so even though there are not specific recommendations regarding this in the treatment guideline, there's a recognition that this has been studied preliminarily. There needs to be further evidence gathered. And in fact, as a result of the adverse events with the use of Elevidys in particularly non-ambulant patients, there'll be a study of 25 individuals who are non-ambulant. But we also are conducting an additional study in ambulant patients to see not only does this influence the adverse event rate related to liver toxicity, but also might increase the efficacy. And of course, that will change the risk-benefit discussion so that we may see this become part of the standard practice.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Byrne to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on August 25th, newly announced data from the ADAPT-CERON study showed that intravenous efgartigimod met its primary endpoint, demonstrating statistically significant and clinically meaningful impacts on patients with seronegative myasthenia gravis. Based on the data, Argenx is planning to submit a biologics license application to expand its indication in seronegative GMG. Next, on August 29th, the FDA approved a new auto-injector formulation for lecanemab, an anti-amyloid therapy for patients with early-stage Alzheimer's and mild cognitive impairment due to AD. With the decision, the subcutaneous auto-injector becomes the first ever at-home, self-administered option for ongoing Alzheimer's treatment. And finally, on September 3rd, Eisai and Biogen announced a rolling submission to the FDA for the lecanemab subcutaneous autoinjector that would introduce a once-weekly starting dose. If approved, it could potentially give patients and caregivers greater flexibility, enabling treatment to begin and continue at home while offering a choice between intravenous and subcutaneous administration. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com. or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Dr. Byrne.
Dr. Byrne, one of the things that kind of stuck out to me was that there was kind of a little bit of follow-ups at the end of your recommendations talking about health equity, language access, financial assistance, as well as geographic considerations. So what types of strategies do we need to pursue to address things like health equity, including language access, financial assistance, and geographic considerations with gene therapies?
Yeah, well, that's an important point, because when we consider only those who participate in clinical trials who have access through investigational products, where both through the sponsor support and infrastructure that comes with a clinical investigation, all these support systems are provided. In the commercial sense, this falls back on the family, and we find that there are significant burdens that are influence the ability to fully participate and comply with all the monitoring, because patients need to be present for up to 3 weeks around this at the site where the infusions are delivered. So for safety monitoring. And so we've observed that, in some circumstances, whether it's inability to fully take off work or coming from a distance, as you mentioned, language barriers, those are all things where I think through the MDA Care Center network, we have some resources to help families and even providers through the resource center to make them aware of what these special requirements are and what the expectations are so that we're, you know, people come prepared to help us as providers ensure that these treatments are safe and they have the best experience. So yes, in the real world setting, it has been a little more challenging. The other aspect of access that we work through, it takes significant effort to even get a letter of agreement in place and the prior authorization that comes with the complexity of a high-cost drug. So that part is something we're also all learning from. There have been circumstances where, if a patient didn't exactly meet the criteria that were seen in the clinical study, their payer may exclude them from access. So we have strategies now for appealing these decisions against prior authorization, and then of course how to work with our health system to be sure that the product is available and in a timely fashion, and that we provide long-term follow-up both for safety and efficacy.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving pieces that come with the prescribing a gene therapy, especially the follow-up and things of that sort. I think people don't realize how many moving pieces there really truly is when talking about these types of therapeutics, but they are encouraging. And obviously, you know, if we can administer them earlier on, they're going to be a lot more effective for patients. So, you know, figuring out some of these small things are very, very important, kind of helping out the workflow of actually getting these drugs to patients. Dr. Byrne, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day. One last quick question for you, just on a more forward-thinking question, how do we kind of feel as though these recommendations will hope to shape the future for gene therapy treatment in DMD? Obviously, we have one approved right now, but that's not to say that we won't see more come down the road in the future. So just talk a little bit about what we hope to see with these recommendations and how they might shape clinical care going forward.
Well, certainly now we know that there's about 1,100 boys with DMD that have been treated with this modality. We expect other products to follow right along, and there are at least two that are in later stage development. And then we know that there are even exciting additional modalities also based on gene therapy that either involve gene editing, which would be available to at least half of the Duchenne population, where a large piece of the frequently mutated area between exons 45 and 55 can be removed to create a near full-length dystrophin. We know that there are programs developing gene replacement strategies of a near full-length dystrophin, which are mutation-independent. And so all of these together, hopefully, will provide lots of options for patients as new investigational products come along that either have higher tropism for muscle, more specificity for the heart, reduced exposure to the liver, and hopefully lessening liver toxicity. So we're very excited to see these additional products come into the investigational space and hopefully in the very near future be authorized for patients to have access even at earlier ages.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.